We're going to be hearing from two wonderful poets today. And before we start that, I wanted to just take a moment. There's a book by Mary Oliver, who's a poet and an essayist. And this book is called Upstream by Mary Oliver. And I just wanted to read you. I extracted some, I would call it, defining moments for her as to what it means to write poetry and to be a poet. And so she says, the work, and within that work, a chance to take thoughts that are hot and formless, and to place them slowly and with meticulous effort into some shapely, heat-retaining form, even as the gods or nature or the soundless wheels of time have made forms all across the soft, curved universe. That is to say, having chosen to claim my life, I have made for myself, out of work and love, a handsome life. She then further says, the world's working artists are not trying to help the world go round, but forward. The third self has the hunger for eternity, that roofless place, discipline, solitude, concentration. Our first poet is Jennifer Franklin. She is the author of Looming, Elixir Press. There are some of her books here today for sale afterwards. She teaches at the Hudson Valley Writers Center, is co-editor of Slappering Hall Press, and lives in New York City. She concentrated in English and creative writing at Brown University, and she attended Columbia University School of the Arts as a Harvey Baker Fellow. Her poems debuted in the Paris Review's 10 New Poets issue in 1996. Her first-length collection, Looming, won the 14th Annual Editor's Prize from Elixir Press and was published in April 2015. We're very fortunate because today we are going to be hearing from Jennifer some poems from her new book, No Small Gift. It's a very intimate journey she shares about three very serious life challenges: her daughter, who is autistic and epileptic, her divorce, and her survival from cancer. I wondered what was the connection with the two quotes she uses in her preface. Quote one, "Bind me, I still can sing," by Emily Dickinson. The second quote, "One cannot sing just to please someone, however much one loves them, no. Song must come from the heart, pour out from the inmost like a thrush," by Samuel Beckett. Then I found it. I quote from one of her poems. "As a child, I feared birds, their feathers, stealth, from behind, leaving in a flutter. Their freedom terrified me. But most while escaping, all I wanted was to become a creature who rises without thought. My only instinct was not just to sing, but to be song." Let's give a warm welcome to Jennifer Franklin.
Thank you so much, Dee, for inviting me here today to read for all of you and for all of you for coming out. It's really a pleasure. Thank you to Rich and Adrian, who gave up their Sunday to be here for me. So I'm going to read some poems first from Looming, and then I'll read from the new collection, which is not yet out, but will be out in September and can be pre-ordered now on Amazon and next week on Four Way Books website. So as Dee so eloquently stated in her introduction, I write a lot of poems about my daughter and about my cancer. The book Looming mostly dealt with my daughter and her autism and her epilepsy. The whole middle section of the book is poems, persona poems, written in the voice of Demeter to talk about the situation of losing my daughter to autism. They're persona poems, but I'm not going to read any of those today. I'm going to read some other ones that are more directly about her. The first one is called "I Would Like My Love to Die," which is a line from Samuel Beckett. "I would like my love to die, or at least that I did not love you so much. If I could turn my heart to winter, I would not need to do this to the earth. If you did not smile in your sleep or plaster your palm to my face with tenderness, I could leave and shut the trap door of my hostile-lined heart without looking back. I would like my love to die so I would not have to murder everything around me, so I would not have to be the hunter I have become. But you are not going to release me from your unnatural embrace. You pin me beside you with your thin arm around my neck. It does not look strong enough to hold a small animal, but it is." The next poem is also about my daughter. It's called "After Your Diagnosis." "The girl you might have been, I see you everywhere. The six-year-old in my elevator, dissecting her nanny with her haughty stare. The twins at the Louvre in your French clothes, racing towards the winged goddess of victory. The blazing eyes of my friend's son showing off his taekwondo. Ingenious devices of torture. Finally, I found your likeness. Picasso's Infanta Margarita Maria, not Velazquez's porcelain doll, but a breathing girl with stabbing eyes. Now, my heart belongs to the damaged girl of Picasso's twisted vision, gray and green with almond eyes that seem to see everything, and the pursed mouth that you keep closed, almost never speaking. You take pleasure in your refusal to prove or deny how much you know and exactly what solace you see and what terror." The next poem is probably my most well-known poem. It was published originally in Boston Review, and a filmmaker from NYU made a little video of it. You can see it online if you're interested. This is my daughter's body. "If you saw her, you would think she was beautiful. Strangers stopped me on the street to say it. If they talk to her, they see the beauty means nothing. Their sight shifts to pigeons on the sidewalk. Their eye contact becomes as poor as hers. They slip away with varying degrees of grace. I never know how much to say to explain the heartbreak. As her smile sears me, I hold her hand all the way home from the swings. The florist hands her a dying rose, and she holds it gently without ripping the petals like she does to the tulips that stare at us with their insipid faces, pretending that they can hold my sorrow in their outstretched cups because I knew them before I knew grief. They do not understand that they are ruined for me now. I planted 500 bulbs as she grew inside me, her brain already damaged by strands of DNA or something else the doctors do not understand. After her bath, she curls up on me for lullabies, the only time that her small body is still. As I sing, I breathe in her shampooed hair and think of the skeletons in the Musée de Préhistoire in Les Azis. The bones of the mother and baby rest in a glass case in the same position we lie in now. They were buried in that unusual pose, child curled up in the crook of the mother's arm. The archaeologists are puzzled by the position. It does not surprise me at all. It would be so easy to die this way, both of us breathing our last breaths with nursery rhymes on our open lips, the promise of peaceful sleep. The last poem I'm going to read from Looming is called My Herculaneum. I have a poem in here called My Pompeii and one called My Herculaneum. Rich and I just got back from both Pompeii, but Herculaneum was closed, but we stood above it and saw what we will see next time when we go. My Herculaneum. When I arrived, I thought I knew how to live. I saw my future as clearly as new frescoes on stone. What I did not have, I made do without, or invented. The trompe-l'oeil mosaic in the summer triclinium for a real garden, the songs of birds from the nymphaeum's painted trees. Long expert at knowing the world through words of others, I thought there would be time to live. Before her diagnosis, my feeling of fortune, ostentatious as patrician villas, tempted disaster. Like other citizens of Vesuvian towns, I feared disaster would find us, but could not bring myself to pack and leave. Solace comes seldom. As rare as a preserved section of fresco, framed in rough wood by archaeologists to safeguard it still. That's how my insides look now, ruined expanse of smooth stone, graffitied with residue of memory, caught under glass, visible if the light is right with no glare, fragmented, constant, red. So that's Looming. Thank you. Thank you. And the next four are from No Small Gift. Coincidentally, it's being published on my daughter's 18th birthday, September 4th. It's a big day for us. I was just at a performance of Rich's friend's band, and one of the last song they sang was about second chances. And that is what this book is about, Second Chances. This first poem in the book is called Not a Love Story, and it's coming out next month in Gettysburg Review. These rooms are not my home. The last tulip stuffed in cut glass were not witness to betrayal. The child was not always crying or worse. The dog was not put down. Six Delft plates perched on a mahogany shelf did not crash to the floor like weapons. My room was not stripped of furniture so I could recline in its cold arms. The man who wanted us to take vows in church did not give me a disease that bloomed into malignancy. My doctor, his colleague, did not help him hide it. Another surgeon did not take a long slice of my tongue. My Sicilian mother did not beg God for vengeance. He did not tell me I would be alone for the rest of my life before he abandoned our child. I did not wait 5 years to admit I still have a body, nor seven to be loved for the first time. He will not always want my scarred neck under his wrist. This poem, you can see a little video on YouTube if you look it up. The Philosopher Did Not Say. It was first published on Poem A Day from poets.org, Academy of American Poetry. But a friend of mine, a great poet, Daniel O'Brien, made a video of me reading this poem. It's called The Philosopher Did Not Say. What secret had Nietzsche discovered when he walked the Turin streets before he flung his arms around a horse being beaten and collapsed into a decade-long coma? Clinging to the cowering brown beast, he said, "Mother, I am stupid." Wild hair and a three-piece tweed suit constrained the body that held the mind that knew too much. Why am I mining dead men for answers when they were all as mad as I am? The horse, his eyes hollow as those of the Burmese elephant that Orwell shot decades later, had the look of every betrayed creature. Perhaps Nietzsche saw the shock in the animal's eyes, how every human contains the capacity to inflict cruelty, the look that turns to recognition, to resignation, to an eye reflecting a field full of fallen horses. This is a tiny poem called Hubris. It's about my daughter being conceived in Venice. We flew to Venice to conceive you. Now I realize the folly. To create life in an unreal city, burdened by sinking churches. I wanted you to begin like a gold mosaic, folded in Vivaldi, like cherub wings. My punishment is simple. Your legacy mirrors that of obsolete palaces, every lit window wide open to the Grand Canal, all the exquisite rooms empty. So this poem, it's called One Photograph. And some of you may know the book that inspired this. A woman called Anne Weiss was at Auschwitz for just a regular tour. And she was a librarian and asked a lot of questions of the people she was taking the tour from. And they showed her a room hidden in the back where the last transport to Auschwitz, someone had dug up all of the photographs that someone risked his or her life to bury. And it was, this happened in 1986 when she was on this tour. And so Norton published a book called The Last Transport, Eyes from the Ashes. And one of the photographs in the many, they're all very happy wedding photographs, photographs of happy times before all these people were murdered at Auschwitz. And so one could write a poem about every single last one of the photos, but I chose one to write about. And if you get a chance to look it up, the picture is beautiful. It's a mother and a child, and the mother sitting down, the child is holding her shoulders and just looking at her with such love and about to give her a kiss. They hold nothing but each other. Fixed like this forever, mother and daughter, their love survives. Testament to life before God's great silence. No one alive knows or will know their names. Maybe it's wrong for me to mourn them, but I put what remains in a small pewter frame next to my dead grandmother and her sister. When you rest your hands on my shoulders, I think of them, the mother in her house coat, blossoming roses, the girl in her swimsuit, tummy round and innocent. In the cold cattle car, they had no nest but each other. Human cries around them drowned out owls in autumn, smothered everything but stars that watched them suffer. I hope they were together when they died, that their eyes were the last of what they saw in this fallen world. Even in the thick darkness of my living room, I see them embracing, always almost kissing. And the last poem from this book that I'm going to read is one of the only happy-ish or light or at least funny poems in the book. So I try to read it at readings so people don't get too depressed, especially in the summer. It's called How to Ride the Subway Without Getting Hurt. You love it. Don't get into the first or last car on the off chance there's a crash. Snag a seat. Don't look at mothers holding babies while standing hold the pole. Don't stare at fathers who wear their babies in Bjorns, tenderly patting their backs. Don't eavesdrop. Look at your boots, your phone, your watch, your short nails. Don't make eye contact. Stop loving everyone, as Whitman did. Stop thinking of all the men you tried to save. Don't list what every child can do that your daughter will never master. Master yourself. Don't imagine backstories for your fellow passengers that led them to the city, or recite Cavafi's The City, even to yourself. When you eavesdrop, don't ingratiate yourself to strangers or flash videos of cats to the boy next to you to distract him from his angry father. Don't drop anything, and if you do, don't pick it up. Consider it a gift to the universe. Don't look at the blank faces of the passengers who ignore the woman sleeping under the bench. Don't think of your college course when you read Nietzsche and had hope. Never think of college. Don't believe ads for quick divorces, online degrees, cheap medical care, or doctors when they say there's nothing wrong. Don't read the news or sing under your breath. Avoid eye contact. Hope nothing incites the police. Avoid headlines. Forbid yourself to think about the way you felt the last time you were kissed. Don't think about what you're doing. Don't think. Mind the gap. Pretend you can forget about the rat scavenging beneath you. Pretend you can forget. So the last two short poems are brand new. One of them has been published and one hasn't yet, from my new collection. Not sure what the title of that is yet, but stay tuned. The first one is called Wind Phone. Rich heard a podcast on NPR that you guys can Google if you're interested in it. It's a really fascinating podcast about a disconnected phone in a booth in rural Japan where people speak to dead loved ones lost in the 2004 tsunami. It's a really fascinating article. You can read it or you can hear the podcast. You don't yet know that I take care of every weak thing. What frames me still is the copper light of my hair. You wait to tell me your bad news until you're leaving, as if you can bear only so much consolation. If you speak your grief as the gray-haired farmers and fishermen do, on the phone connected to nothing, you may never stop calling the wind. And the last one is called Preparing to Move. They're finally leaving me each old good thought of my favorite park with the dead dog and all the calm days and countries you promised to unruin for me. I'm leaving my body wash, the boar hair brush, a blanket hidden in your rooms. I tell you I want nothing but books, my grandmother's marble table, the Intarsia desk from Florence, but you don't believe me. You think I covet my relics, giraffe scratched on banana paper, a Venetian glass vase. You think I want to pack boxes deep as caves. The ones who love me know it's true and think my disavowals a sign that I've learned nothing. They don't understand that having lain in a machine for 7 weeks while oncologists irradiated my sliced tongue and slashed neck, I learned to leave my home as if I were never coming back. That lying robed in that cold cavern severed any attachment to my sleigh bed or cabinets stuffed with souvenirs, animals caught under snow globes, dancers smothered in porcelain lace. They cannot know that each day blooms into a ceremony of leave-taking, that when I say goodbye, I mean it, that all words are only practice for no. Thank you so much for coming out today. I really appreciate it. Thanks again, Dave, for having me.
Jennifer has a line in one of her poems. It says, "I am never where I am." Well, Jennifer, you are totally here. And thank you for that intimate and skillful reading. Thank you.
Not you anymore, by the way.
That's good. Our next reader is Gladys Henderson. Gladys Henderson's poems have been featured on PBS, Channel 21, in the production Shoreline Sonata, and her work has appeared in several journals and many anthologies, such as A Taste of Poetry, Block Island Poetry Project, Great Neck Plaza Public Poetry Project, Long Island Sounds, Long Island Quarterly, Pominock, and the Suffolk County Poetry Review. She was a finalist for the Palman Poetry Prize in 2006 and recognized in the Writer's Digest Poetry Competitions in 2008, 9, and 12. She was named the Walt Whitman Birthplace Poet of the Year in 2010 and recently Poet Laureate of Suffolk County Right Now for 2017 to 2019. Her chapbook, Eclipse of Heaven, was published in 2009. Gladys's poetry launches us into the natural world. You'll find yourself gently rocking on a boat captained by her brother, or divining the meaning of life from a milkweed pod. She can weave a long narrative rich like the richest chocolate pudding, and then just as you tilt the last spoonful into your mouth, the denouement reveals itself. Sometimes ominous, but more often ethereal, she finds tenderness, which allows us to relax into her devotion to nature. Here is a poem inspired by a photograph of that first dusting of frost on leaves in fall called Frost in the Fields. The poem is woven so masterfully, we hardly know how we end up on a battlefield. And I'd like to add, since that I'm glad to see that Gladys goes through many iterations, because this, the one she sent me today for me to make it easy for me to read it, is completely different, almost completely different than the one I read on the internet. So I was happy to see that even a poet laureate revises. Yes. Even when it's in print, it gets revised to revise. That's an interesting part of poetry. Frost in the Fields. Sojourner, run your fingertips along the stem. See if the splinters cut the thin puffs of your skin. Maybe that is all one needs to do, to waste death from its devotion and calling, its reverence for itself. See how the magenta leaves hang spent, their tissues thin and soft, the silver fuzz of demise, like the beard of a young soldier fallen in the field, resigned to the future. How striking the solemnity of endings, when we all know points us towards what is unknown, like a chaplain in the field who caresses the face of a soldier as if touch might change what is already finished. Thank you. Gladys, please come and give a warm welcome to Gladys.
Oh my, now I see why you're standing on your toes. But I don't think I'll be able to stand on my toes.
All righty.
I might have to take some of that water too. So thank you, Dee, for inviting me to this fabulous event, and how wonderful it is to have the success of all these years, and how thankful I am to be here. And I want to thank everybody else also who's come today and has chosen this as opposed to some other place to be. I mean, if you think about it, there's so much wonderful things happening that you could very well be in 1,000 different places with 1,000 wonderful things to do. So thank you so much for coming. I want to let you know I've been very blessed most of my life to be able to have been living or been part of both the North and South Forks of our island. My aunt lived in Mattituck and lived for many, many years, so part of my life was literally going up the Mattituck. And I attended South Hapton during the summer when I wasn't teaching. So it's not a new place for me. And I sort of know the back way to get home up through Sag Harbor, which most people don't know. The first poems that I'm going to read to you today were experienced in East Hampton and at Orient Point. And one was written the day after fishing all day in Orient Point and catching some fish, and some men came off a party boat and were unsuccessful at their fishing day, and the poem takes off into that world. And the second is about a tender moment in Cedar Point Park, which is not far from here. The first is two women fishing Orient Point Beach. Two women fishing Orient Point Beach. Across that precious blue, boats drifted for flounder. Come late summer, schools of tommy cod skimmed the clear sandy bottom for the sheen of snapper, the silver flash of sand eels. I cast the line from the long black rod into the inlet. It is the one that belonged to my father, the one he wound with red and yellow thread, ferrules cast with silk. I remember my hands clasping the bottom while it spun in slow and calculated circles, wrapping the metal with its bright windings. Air drifted with the fragrance of cedar fires rising from the beach. Near us, sounds of lovers laughing and playing. A gull, seeing our fishing bucket and a box of bait, called several times, announcing some intent, perhaps to distract us, that he might swoop down and relish his desire. It was the day the two men came to talk to us, back from their fisher charter without a single keeper, sometime before sunset, retrieving our fishing lines to go home, our lures passed through a school of tommy cod, hooking each one without effort. Fish were splashing in the bucket. We laughed together. The cool September air rewarded our breaths with ghosts of mist rising in the twilight. The beach turned rose in the lens cast by the last light. We drove home that evening, down back roads onto Sound Avenue, 2 hours in ritual silence, as if we had come to the Ganges, filled with its promises, unclothed ourselves, and for the first time, saw our sameness. So we go now to Cedar Point Park. Ground fires. We sat beneath the shadow of St. Anne's Cross, eating shrimp and bread. Later, we drifted the tidal flow at Cedar Point. Amazed, the water was still clear. All around us, sand dunes ripe with honeysuckle, blossoms yellow as Irish butter, white as a winter moon. We hid our sides behind the flowered vines, dried our bodies, smoothed the towel across our necks and thighs, the place where lovers kiss. In perfect stillness, the sound of cloth on anointed skin. So into that same world, Cedar Point Park, I took a group of poets and their children, not all of them, a few children, and we went up to Cedar Point Park in the morning to read poems to each other. It was part of my initiative as poet laureate, to read poems to each other. That's what we did. We sat in a circle and we read poems. And it was a time at which we were talking about war with North Korea. So we needed a little healing time. And this poem came from that day. Portrait of a summer's day in August. Some had lost their way on roads whose names had changed, traveled through woods that gave no clues. But by mid-morning, all had made their way to the gate and driven the dapple road through ancient oaks, past tidal ponds, and turned the corner at the playground, too early for children to have risen, circled the ball field, sounds of yesterday's games imagined, balls striking wood, players reaching hard into the play, and at the turn, finally, we saw the bay, its sapphire water shimmering with sunlight. There was a sense of heaven that morning. Woods were instance with the breath of cedars. Songbirds and gull cries opened the stillness, offering a calming music to worried ears worn out by life's events and the new talk of war. We circled our chairs like pioneers, read our poems to each other, and the children in their summer play best read also, sounding out words, mining for the right one. We leaned into their innocence, their desire to please us. How much we needed each other that day, becoming angels for each other, announcing in loud, proclaiming voices, fear not, fear not. Those declarations archangeled all the perils feared or planned by those in command. Far away, traffic noise, the clutter of our lives. In front of us, a cloudless sky, gallant cedars with branches rooted into clear, washed air, high bush blueberries holding fast to the sandy bluff, their ancient, persistent, clutching firm to what endures and sustains, and all of us. Amen. So, we need to do a great deal to keep our island in good shape. Every day we really have to work at that, and we hope that the politicians who can do the most for us hear what needs to be done and don't become frightened by the politic. Undelivered letter. Today, the light shifts. Air is warm on the outside, cold on the inside, and autumn rests just offshore, waiting its turn. Already, hassocks in the marshlands has started to change summer green to gold. Bluefish and porgy fatten themselves on bait fish. Their royals on the bay's surface, polished gold bands set with lips of September sun. This morning, goldfish sway on the lilac cornflowers, devouring their ripe black seeds. Queen Anne's lace and blue chicory have finished their last flowerings. It would have been wrong for me not to have written. Time grows shorter now. At daybreak, advancing down the expressway, bulldozers and backhoes. I fear another field of trees will fall, another piece of shoreline will go. Oh, how beautiful this island. I give it to you now. Before it is all gone, I wanted to wait. I've already waited too long. It is yours. It has always been. Not mine to give, but it's yours to receive. A little bit of water. I think I just saw an ant very interested in that water. I may have to kill him. No, I won't. These next poems that I've written are written in places in which the sea or the river or lakes are involved. Some of them were in fact written in Belgrade Lakes, Maine, where in fact on the very same lake where E.B. White actually stayed and wrote his essay, Once More to the Lake. And I tell it to you that because it's pretty much the same way it was then as it is now. It's been owned by the same family. Anyway, these poems are written by those pieces of water that have given me comfort. My family made their living with the sea. There are ship captains in it. And my brother, in fact, was a clammer. He earned his living clamming as well as lobstering. When lobstering and clamming could still be done on most of Long Island, it becomes more and more narrow each year. And I think probably the reason I do write about those things is because I can somehow sort my life near water where those edges meet. I can somehow find peace in those environments. In the quiet, fishermen load their skiffs, take off into the early rise of morning, engines breaking the silence, bows separating the mist, only to have it close again in their wakes, the warm lake and cold autumn air in concert. September and the lake has begun its slow turn towards winter, months having fallen away, its shoulders now rich with yellows and reds, swamp maple and birch leading the march of time's uncontested patterns. The first leaves have started to give way. Even in the windless air, they twist and glide, some cascading, others throwing themselves to the ground as if in a rush to finish. This morning, I tried to decipher the sound as they scuffle across the porch or land on the ground near my feet. Perhaps it's a grandmother's kiss, a quiet press of lips on a child's soft cheek, or a mouse who has found his way to our forbidden treats and crackled his way to pleasure. Or perhaps it's the memory of summer's desires fallen from the trees where feet might find them again and remember. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Exaltation. I have already announced my exaltations to the lake, sparkling with sun flames, to the bright cold air that fills my lungs. Soon I will walk my morning down to the dock to check the lines, up the same path to visit the fragrant blossoming trees. Astonished, astonished how all of this could have come to me. This next poem was written 15 miles out to sea on Monhegan Island, home of many painters, including Fairfield Porter and Bellows. Saul Bellows actually was there, and all of the Wythes painted there. And there's also a few poets there. And this poem was written on that island. Island morning. All morning, the surf breaks on Burnt Head, giving up her secrets. She throws them on the rocks one word at a time. Whispers, cries, a nursery rhyme, the sound of a man's voice. Eggs roll in boiling water. I watch the clock. A voice in my head from childhood speaks. Only 3 minutes. The toast is down. Butter and marmalade sit on a cream-colored plate. I place the eggs in a small white bowl, carry them to the table, take my knife, break the egg in two, turn it yolk side up, pinch on grains of salt and pepper, swallow the history of my mornings. The cries of an animal rise from the beach. Someone must love it enough to search for it. Leaves are turning upward, the sky white with rain. Too cold for a stranger to find me, too far for a friend to walk on unknown ground. And while I was in Monhegan, I was very fortunate to speak to an 80-year-old who, at that time, this is 20 years ago, who had remembered the old days of lobstering when they had wooden traps and lots of the equipment that they don't have now. And he told me the story. I asked him what it was like to lobster in the middle of winter, because trap day on Monhegan Island was at that time January 1st. That's the day that they dropped their traps into the ocean. And from that story, from that discussion with me, 3 years ago, the poem was written. Invocation. Early morning, two men struggle towards the sea, beards covered with breath frost, heads capped in lamb's wool, bare skin protected, except their faces, which gleam crimson as if seduced. In cold silence, they drag a small dory, its bow and keel engraving narrow tracks through unblemished snow. Soon they will leave land and enter the liturgy of tides, whose chrism consecrates hands that exchange money for lobsters and skeletons of men gone overboard with their traps. One in the bow, one in the stern, they will row in tandem away from warm cottages and lovers, mounting large waves, driving the bow straight into them. They'll watch as the windows of their homes become smaller and will turn their heads to steer towards the boat half a mile away. She swings on lines of icy glimmer covered in ermine mantles of snow. At each draw of the oars, they will bow their bodies as if in deep prayer or gesture of servitude to her dominion. Thank you. These next poems were written in the last few years. They were influenced a great deal by the current news. They were also influenced by my cancer diagnosis in 2015 and the surgery. And what I learned is that we, of course, live in a world that adaptation is always part of it. To go on is to adapt. Introit for a requiem. Introit for a requiem, Lord of the imagined brief hour when there is no pain and everyone's son or daughter is free from war, hear us, please. Perhaps we have lost your ear. Sounds of bombs have made you deaf. But we are here, filled with fear. Bury our children. Lord of the imagined brief hour when there is no pain and everyone's son or daughter is free from war, hear us, please. Perhaps we have lost your ear. Sounds of bombs have made you deaf. But we are here, filled with fear. Bury our children. News from Las Vegas, October 1st, 2017. From a room on the 32nd floor from golden mirrors broken through billowing curtains under Venus night, at a point above, a fallen one trapped, fury, frenzy, blood, bodies, run, stay, run, fall, executions, death. Death, malignant seeds cast with a random swing, 2, 3, 4, 7 come 11, see how they fall, landscapes of arms, legs, blood, run, fall, Lord high of mighty stakes, with the winning hand all in, they folded one after another, his hand a caliper hand, toxic plan, twist, a pit, a grave, from above, through curtains, blowing in a vile wind, they fell, and no one knew from where, hell so far away, but the devil close. real close. And my last two poems, both are autobiographical. All poems are not autobiographical. And they would be considered prose poems, and no further explanations necessary. I will need another drink of water. Holding anchor. In that black, a thousand bad dreams, deep soprano sounds of the tide slapping the cheeks of the skiff, a foghorn savior just out of reach calling, believe, believe, summoning us to step out of the light safety, make our way through the inlet without moon or stars, find our way home in total blindness, follow like disciples with only sound to guide our way. My brother, the captain who wears his tightened chin and teeth like a life preserver, moves to the wheel as though the wood itself had memory of the harbor, knew what he did not know. What does a younger sister understand who venerates even the wool shirt he wears in full summer? Does she ask if he knows the way? Has he taken the coordinates to find home? His 12 years senior allows none of that. I await his commands, make another pot of coffee, hope someone hears the gurgling of our engines in neutral, anchored off, fuel enough for now, running lights and floods hold us in the falsehood of artificial day. A full, delicious light bathing the fish that splash their soon-to-be-lost lives in our buckets. And we have sandwiches of ham and cheese, lots of cold beer, wine. We are somewhere off Eaton's neck, and night having come quickly, the excitement of fishing for fluke almost willing to jump into our boat intoxicating. And we are without chart of cove or home, adrift like children whose parents might someday recognize their talents, march them around town as the gifted ones that know everything. But for now, we are not. And as always, my brother and I float the obscure darkness like the old familiar nightmare she is, anchored down until someone finds us, sees our strobe lights through the encircling black fog, or hears the diesels drinking away our fuel, the snap of beer tabs opening, our noisy ship-to-shore staticky news from sailors not lost at sea. But for us, we sit and wait for the dawn or rescue, my earrings flashing in the spotlight, their vigilant veneer soothing the long night's passage back to home. Thank you. An American Hymn 2017. These are the streets you walk, the dust on the soles of your shoes, a finely ground gold of dried sweat, crying, hungry children, lice, disease, and dreams, dreams of a welcoming America through hard work. Your sweat, the baptism of the able, opiate of the hopeful, a fuel that hangs as smog over the Brooklyn Bridge on the lawns of the rich, whose alien workers square-edge the ravel growth of suburban grass, or work in houses where others examine the quality of work not good enough or wonderful, but it is not their work. The burden of that yoke bought by the grandparents of those before. Born in America, native part of the land, less than 100 years for most, not alien, but American, yes, American. Many have forgotten their own lineage of exclusion, the cold water flats, hunger, rats, roaches, and those who believe their relatives were not worthy, dirty, smelled. Alien, immigrant, refugee, deportee. Some came through Ellis, others by private boat or plane, some with real names that processors could not understand, many with papers that paid their way to a new slavery, and others who stole their entry with money and assets. They're all American now, through lies or truth. I saw them hungry, watched them polish shoes in Grand Central Station, washing cars of the middle class in Smithtown, cleaning floors, walls of houses, pruning grass, digging grapes, cutting carrots at the local restaurant for salads. When I was a guest in their homes for dinner, they spoke American past serving plates overflowing with food. America grandness, even if later in the week there would be little or no food. I was the honored and celebrated. I was born in the country of their hope of hopes, their choice, this place of refuge. In vague outlines I have hidden, beneath posters and banners in the safety of silence. But I speak for you now, Maria, who came from Poland, was a Jew, too frightened to tell anyone, and celebrated your matter-of-fact acceptance a Saturday. I took you to services at Temple Emmanuel. And for you, Iqing, who hid in your mother's arms as bombs fell on your city, one of the lucky ones to survive, who worked wrapping gifts at the local Macy's, and how you treated us to New Year's in Chinatown, my mother eating shark fin soup, 1,000-year-old eggs, venerated like your own mother. And for you, Jose, whose father was killed by assassins and mother passed away from grief, who danced with me at your wedding, the dance reserved for mothers, even though you owed me no homage, the work you did for me above all expectations. I do not know where any of them are now. Perhaps they have decided to stay. In their eyes, I saw a certain type of hope, one that irons out the wrinkles of maps, that lays out topography of countries as tablecloth beneath the elbows of common hungers. When I watched their faces, saw their smiles, cleared the table after supper, I saw my family and wept that they knew me as one of them. Thank you.
Gladys, thank you for that huge range of the OUVRE. Just thank you for that grand expanse of inclusion and metaphor, and it was just lovely. Thank you.